Okay, we are live in the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building in Greenwich Village. It is a pleasure tonight to welcome Neil Langteau, in true French-Canadian hockey player style. I don't want to mispronounce the name, Neil Langteau. Neil is the author of Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella, published by Simon & Schuster. And thank you so much for coming up from the outskirts of Philadelphia. We really appreciate this. For those of you listening on our podcast audience, and for those who don't know Neil, Neil is a historian who has written extensively about baseball. His book, Negro League Baseball, The Rise and Ruin of a Black Institution, was widely praised and won the Sabre Seymour Medal for the best book of baseball history or biography. So we don't have a stiff from Philadelphia here tonight. And it's a pleasure to welcome you, Neil. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And I almost forgot, we normally start our podcast with this, so we'll get it in now. To those of you who are here for the first time in the clubhouse, welcome. To those of you who have been here before, welcome home. Now we're going to turn it over to Neil for our baseball discussion. And I guess to start, you're a Boston Red Sox fan.
Yes, I know I'm in enemy territory right now. But
well, unfortunately, I'm a Mets fan, so we're okay.
Okay.
And you're a relatively young guy. So you're a Red Sox fan and you're a young guy. So my first question is, what drew you to Roy Campanella?
That's a good question. I mean, basically, it goes back to being a baseball fan as a kid. I loved baseball growing up. I grew up in Rhode Island. And when Soccer Rhode Island, the home of two Hall of Famers, Gabby Hartnett and Apple Joy, believe it or not. And I also loved history as a kid. So it was a fusion of those two things, baseball and history. And then when I got into graduate work, I got into the Negro League thing. I'd never really knew much about the Negro Leagues. And once I discovered them as something that had not been much written about, that's how I ended up doing my first book about the Hilldale Baseball Club, and that was in the 90s. And then from there, I did the book on Negro League Baseball. He's got all my books over there. He's got the rare one, the rare hardcover of the first book. I did the Negro League Baseball, The Rise and Ruin of a Black Institution book in 2004. And from there, I was just looking for another project to do. And as I was telling someone before we started here, Campanella just seemed like a perfect subject. He was someone who there had not been much written about in years. I mean, really nothing in 50 years since his own autobiography. And I thought he just had a great story. And what's also important in publishing, it seemed to be marketable. I mean, because his story was so compelling. And the fact he played in New York and Los Angeles, all these things publishers are attracted to. So all these things came into play when it came time for me to pursue the topic. And that's how I got into the subject of Campy.
So let's start with a little bit, if you could, just for our audience, talk a little bit about Campy's childhood, because I think it's quite interesting, and lead us from that kind of the childhood into the Negro League.
Sure.
Let's stay with that time frame.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's interesting about Campy is his background. I mean, he was born in Philadelphia in 1921 to a biracial background. His mother was African American, and his father was Italian. And that was exceptional at the time. I mean, it just was a rarity. I think it was a little difficult for him. He talked about how he was called half-breed and was taunted and things like that. But he pretty much self-identified as African-American because in those days, if you had a drop of black blood, you were considered black. And so he pretty much was considered himself black. But he was very proud of his Italian side, too. He didn't certainly avoid that. He was a kid who loved nothing but baseball. That's it. I mean, he wasn't interested in anything else except playing baseball. And from a very early age, he was playing it, and he was outstanding. He was so far above his contemporaries. When he was like 11, 12, he was playing with guys 16, 17, such that when he was 15 years old, he was so good that he got picked up by the Negro Leagues. And this is, I mean, he started playing professional baseball at age 15. I mean, it's an unbelievable story. He's probably the youngest player in Negro League history. And the fact that he stuck, I mean, he got signed at 15, and they kept him. I mean, he never got sent home. I mean, so it just shows you how mature he was for his age, and also what a great player he was at a very early age. And there's some pictures of him when he's 15 years old in my book of him catching. He was very, still, he was a big guy at 15, but he was not as big as he got later on with the Dodgers.
And so when he's 15, 16, how did the other guys who were men, how did they treat him? Was he treated as kind of a younger brother? Were there difficult times?
I think some of them didn't know what to make of him. I think that they probably thought, who is this little kid? He's like the bad boy. He's the age of the bad boy on our team. But I think they respected him because he was good. I mean, he wasn't a starter, but he was a backup catcher. He would play, and he would do a decent job. One of the stories I have in the book is about the great Josh Gibson. Some of you probably heard of Josh Gibson, the great catcher, one of the greatest catchers of all time. And Gibson just thought it was so funny that there was this little 15-year-old playing in the Negro League, and he kind of made fun of him, but he kind of took him under his wing a little bit, even though they're on different teams. Gibson played for the Homestead Grays and the Crawfords. And Gibson, you know, with time started to really respect him. And by the early 40s, Gibson started to, he said, you're growing up. You know, you're getting to be so good. I mean, when he was 18 or 19, he was already one of the best catchers in the Negro League. So I think at the beginning, I think no one really took him seriously, but he proved himself that he was not there just as a novelty and that he could play ball and had to put up with a lot of crap. So, I mean, he loved the game so much, I don't think he cared what he had to put up with. I mean, the conditions of the Negro Leagues in the 30s were pretty hard. They got paid very little. I think he got $60 a month when he started out in 1937, and that wasn't much even then. But for him, that might have been $1 million because he just loved to play baseball, and the fact they were giving him money was just icing on the cake for him.
So now in the year, so he starts in about 37.
37, yeah.
And in 48, he becomes a Brooklyn Dodger. How old was he at that point? He was
born in 21, so he became a Dodger in 48. An interesting part of Campy's story is that he almost could have integrated the major leagues before Jackie did. In 1942, during the war, there was a lot of pressure put on the major leagues, and it got so bad that the commissioner for baseball, Landis, who was never pro-integration by any stretch of the imagination, Landis finally cracked, and he gave a statement in the summer of 42. He said, basically, shut up, leave me alone. There is no rule against signing black players. And there was one owner who decided to do something about it. It was the owner of the Pittsburgh Pirates, William Benswanger. William Benswanger was someone who was very familiar with the Negro League players, and he gave a statement that said, I will give black players a tryout. And he listed three players. One of them was Roy Campanella. This was 1942. And everyone thought, it's going to happen. This is going to be the year it happens. But someone got to Benswanger. I actually talked to Benswanger. I was talking about before we started. Benswanger's son is still alive, lives in Pittsburgh. And the story is that Benswanger, the owner, someone got to him. Either it was Commissioner Landis or the other owners. And they put a lot of pressure on him to not go through with this tryout. This was in 42. And so Campy didn't get that chance in 42. I think he was very, very disappointed because I think he always felt that he could have been and should have been the first before Jackie Robinson. We're getting ahead of that story. We'll get to that in a little while. Yeah. As it turned out, after that didn't go through, he was so disillusioned that he left the country, went to Mexico. He played in the Mexican leagues for a couple of years, came back to America in 45, and then got signed by Ricky in early 46. Jackie was signed in fall of 45, and Newcomb and Campy were signed in early 46. So he spent 46 and 47 in the minors, and then 48 came up to Brooklyn.
Is that the first time he met Jackie Robinson?
He met Robinson in 45. At the end of the 45 season, Campy was hanging around in New York after the season was over. He was planning to go to Venezuela on a barnstorming tour, and Jackie was supposed to go too. That's how he first met him. And that's where they first met, and Jackie told Campy that, I've just talked to Branch Rickey about signing with the Dodgers. And as it turned out, Campy had also talked to Rickey about going with the Dodgers, whereas Campy didn't know what the hell Rickey was talking about. He thought Rickey was going to sign him for some Negro League, this thing called the United States League. And Campy didn't really take it seriously and basically told him he wasn't that interested. And Rickey said, well, don't sign your contract between now and next year. And then Campy met with Jackie at the Hotel Teresa, which was an African-American hotel in Harlem. And Jackie said, Rickey's on the level. I'm signing with Brooklyn in a week. And that's when he knew it was for real. And that's when Campy and Jackie first got together and were friends. They became friends at that point.
And we'll get into a little bit more of the Jackie Campy story because I think you uncovered a ton. It seems like one of the things about Campy in general, Roy Campanella in general, is that there's a lot of myth attached to his stories over time, either because of myths that he put out himself or that kind of snowballed from other factors. And you uncovered a lot that I think was never really known before until this wonderful book.
Yeah, it's kind of fun of writing the book is kind of sifting through Campy's 50 million stories on everything. He would tell a different story. You see four different versions of the same incident. He was a great spin doctor. I mean, all celebrities are. All celebrities create a self for themselves and for the public. Campy was particularly astute at it. And he did present himself a certain way, that he was a lovable, friendly guy. And there was a lot of that in him. That was true. But he also kind of portrayed himself as sort of a Will Rogers in a baseball uniform. He never met a man he didn't like. And he was this... I mean, and some of the other players got a little resentful of that. They felt that he was too much of a... He was too press savvy. I mean, he was very press savvy. He knew how to work the press very well, whereas Jackie Robinson didn't know how to work the press, nor did he want to know. He didn't care about that kind of PR stuff. And I think that was one of the issues that he and Jackie would have. That Campy wanted to be liked by the public, and he was very much liked. He was probably one of the most popular players in the 50s across America, not just in Brooklyn. I mean, he was he was one of the first great popular black players. I mean, Jackie was not so popular. Jackie was respected, but he wasn't beloved, whereas Campy was. And that's just the way, in the 50s, that's the way it was, I think.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. We actually have a piece here in the clubhouse from this magazine. I think it's from 1951. It's what the other ballplayers think about Jackie Robinson. It's actually quite racist, the way it's written, kind of in between the lines.
Mm-hmm.
But it's exactly that point.
Yeah, Jackie took a lot of abuse in the 50s. I think Campy kind of looked at the scene in the 50s and decided it doesn't make any sense for me to speak out, because if you speak out and say anything, you will get raked over the coals by the press, as Jackie did. Jackie would speak out, and he would be criticized very harshly by the press. He would get booed, and he would even be booed by the... I mean, I found instances where they were saying even the Ebbets Field, he was getting booed by fans, because people thought he was too outspoken, he was a pop-off, he was too aggressive. And of course, it was because he was a black man doing these things, which black players were not supposed to do at that time. So Campy, I think, said, I'm not going to gain anything doing that, so I will be much more the Dale Carnegie approach, win friends and influence people. And that's the way he approached things in the 50s. Jackie did not, and Jackie was criticized much more. It was constantly involved in scrapes with the league office, the National League office. Warren Giles was always calling him in for this and that. So, you know, Jackie didn't care. He sort of liked being in the center of everything like that, but that wasn't Campy's way.
Yeah, I guess you couldn't find two different personalities. More, you know, So take us a little bit through that relationship.
Yeah.
Of it seems like they were very close,
mm-hmm.
not close at all, and then there was a reconciliation at some point. So take us a little bit through that.
Yeah, they were very close at first, even though they had almost nothing in common, because Jackie was a college man. He didn't graduate, but he did do, I think, 3 years at USC or UCLA.
UCLA.
He didn't graduate, but he had college, and that was certainly something exceptional at the time for white players or black players. Very few college men in baseball at the time. Campy was a ninth grade dropout, so they had a lot of education. On the other hand, Campy and Jackie got along pretty well. I did interview Rachel Robinson for the book, and Rachel Robinson told me, she said, you know, we really got along well at first. We socialized together. They even bought homes in the same neighborhood in Queens. I mean, they were a couple blocks from one another. They were very, very close for a while, very, very friendly, and then things fell apart over a couple of issues. One of the issues was about money. There was a barnstorming. Jackie used to take barnstorming teams at the end of the season. He'd go all over the country. And he'd take a bunch of black players and go from town to town, and they make a lot of money. And after the 49 season, they did this, and in the middle of the tour, and they were making so much money, and Campy, Newcomb, and Larry Doby, who were along for the ride with Jackie, found out that Jackie was getting paid on a percentage basis, whereas they were getting a flat fee. And they were furious. They thought, Jackie's hogging all the money, Jackie's not fair, blah, 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 blah. They threatened to pull out of the tour. And Jackie's feeling was, well, I made my deal with the promoter. You made your deal. It's not my fault. You didn't make a better deal. So he kind of had that attitude. And they were very unhappy about it, but they continued on the tour. Campy was incensed about it. And the following spring training, that's when the story broke that Campy and Jackie were not speaking to one another. It was over this issue of the money. And that was the first real break between them. And then the break got wider in the 50s over civil rights issues because Jackie was much more willing to speak out in the 50s about things. And Campy, he would say, I'm not a politician. I'm not a crusader. I don't want to talk about that kind of stuff. I just want to play baseball. And because of that, Jackie got very angry with him. As he got angry with Willie Mays, the same thing, because Mays was the same kind of player. Mays also did not want to speak out. Mays just wanted to play baseball. That wasn't his makeup. So by the mid-50s, Campy and Jackie were on the same team and not speaking to one another at all. I talked to Carl Erskine, writing a book, and Erskine said, he said, you couldn't see, on the field you wouldn't see it. He said they didn't have any confrontations in the clubhouse or anything like that. He said, you know, everything seemed to be okay on the surface, but they just didn't speak. And that didn't even change until, even when Campy had his accident, I was very surprised to see after the accident, Jackie gave a statement to Mike Wallace. And Mike Wallace was writing a column in those days, I think it was the New York Post. And Mike Wallace did a column with Jackie after the accident. And Jackie said, well, I hope he gets better, but we're still not going to be friends because I have nothing to say to him. It was very typical Jackie, because Jackie was very blunt. He could be very tactless at times. I mean, he really could. He didn't have that kind of. He was not a cuddly type. Like, and Campy was a big teddy bear kind of. And Jackie was straight shooter, and he rubbed people the wrong way sometimes. They finally made up in the 60s when Jackie was doing a book called Baseball Has Done It. It was a book about how African-American players, the struggles they had faced in the last 15 years. And Jackie went around interviewing all different black players and talked about their experiences. And Campy participated and gave a very forceful discussion about civil rights, showing that he had changed his ways. And Jackie was just very happy about it, and that's when they made up. And there's a picture in the book of Campy and Jackie at Campy's liquor store in Harlem having a press conference together in 64, and that was... That's when they made up. And they were on pretty good terms the rest of Jackie's life, which wasn't that long. Jackie only lived a few more years after that. Jackie died in 72. Jackie's health was not very good. He had diabetes and a few other problems. So that's the whole Jackie Campy saga. And that's a big part of the book. I mean, there's a lot of these two guys. I think it's a baseball story, but it's a civil rights story, how these two men chose to deal with their celebrity in the 50s. You know, I mean, all black celebrities have the same issue going on, whether they were in baseball or other things. Or other sports too, whether you should get involved in civil rights issues. In the 50s, no one wanted to. Everyone was afraid. I mean, it's McCarthy period. No one really wants to speak out. So Jackie was pretty much the lone wolf in the 50s speaking out about anything. Because you have someone like
Don Newcomb in that combo.
Good question. Newcomb managed to get along with both of them. But I would say when push came to shove, he was more on Campy's side. Now, Newcomb today tries to spin it that he was in Jackie's side, but I think Newcomb makes up stories today. Sorry, Don, if you're listening. because there's a story in the book about the Chase Hotel in St. Louis, and the story was about whether 1954, the Chase Hotel was this very nice hotel in St. Louis where black players were not allowed to stay for years and years and years. And in 54, the hotel finally said, black players can stay, but they can't use the pool, and they can't use the bar, and they can't use the dining room, but they can stay in their rooms. And so Jackie said, all right, fine, I'll do it. And Campy and the rest of the other black players on the team, at that point there were about five or six. I think there was Jim Gilliam and there was Joe Black and Amoroso. It was about five or six at the time. And they all said, no, we're not. We're going to go stay in the black hotel. And it became a huge furor in the black press about, you know, why is Campy and his group, why are they accepting segregation by staying in a black hotel? Anyway, it's a much-told story. Roger Kahn talks about it in Boys of Summer. And the end up of the story was that the Dodgers said, you know, from now on, all the black players will stay at the Chase Hotel. There'll be no more segregating the players. And today, Newcomb always says, oh, I was on Jackie's side from the beginning, and I wanted to stay in the Chase Hotel, blah, 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 blah. But that's not really true at all. I mean, when you read, you can read the news stories at the time where Newcomb says, I'm going with Campy. Jackie's just a big pop-off. He's always trying to get attention. So there was that kind of tension between the two of them at the time. I think there was sort of a division on the black players. I think sometimes they chose either one side or the other. I've read that Gilliam was more of a Jackie man than a Campy man, but it's hard to tell.
And during that time with the white Brooklyn Dodgers, mm-hmm. how was Campy's relationship with which is basically the majority of the team, how was his relationship in the 50s? He played for 10 years in the and with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he won 3 MVP awards, which is unbelievable. I don't know if anyone else.
It is unbelievable. I think Barrett did it at the same time. He and Barrett both won 3. It was a golden age for catchers in New York. I think Kempe got along with pretty much everyone on the team. I did speak to Buzzy Bevesi, who died only recently. Buzzy Bevesi was well into his 90s, and he and for those of you who don't know, he was the president and GM of the Dodgers in those years. Knew everything going on with the Dodgers. And Bevesi said, you know, he said Kempe was kind of a loner. He said Reese was probably the closest to him on the team. You know, wasn't particularly close to anyone else on the club. He wasn't part of it. It was sort of a clique of certain players. But, I mean, there was no one who he didn't like. So I think he did get along with most players. Now, early in his career, I think there were some who didn't get along with some of the Southern players. When he first came up in 48, Hugh Casey was still on the Dodgers. And he was a good old boy from the South. And Hugh Casey said, I'm not going to take signs from a black man. I will not take his signs. So Kempe comes in for his first major league game, and Hugh Casey's on the mound. And Kempe said, okay, just throw what you're going to throw. Because he wouldn't listen to him. So Hugh Casey just threw his own pitches. And he had to just take them. Wow. And Casey was gone by the end of the year. I think Ricky got rid of some of these guys purposely. Dixie Walker's another one. Dixie Walker was kind of not too keen on, although Lee Loewenfisch, we were talking about.
Right.
For those, Lee Loewenfisch is the biographer of Brad Trickey. Lee Loewenfisch thinks that Dixie Walker may have gotten a bad rap, perhaps was not as racist as he's been painted in the years following that. But needless to say, at the beginning of the season in 47, Dixie Walker did not want to play on the Dodgers with Jackie on the team. He may have come to some kind of peace later on, but Ricky did move him after the 48 season. I think Ricky did try to move out players who might be uncomfortable playing with Jackie and Kempe and Newcomb, you know. So I don't think there was a whole lot of tension on the Dodgers. There's a quote in the book where Kempe even said something to the effect that if there was ever any tension, Buzzy took care of it. Being Buzzy Bevesi, he would nip it in the bud, and I think they would move the player or send him down or whatever.
Okay, so now we went through basically the 50s. So now we get to this fateful January 1958 evening. There's been a lot written about it, correctly and incorrectly, before your book. So if you could just take us to that night of January 1958.
Yeah, this was one of the most interesting things I was able to dig up in writing this book. You know, for years, the story of that night has been told fairly simply, that Kempe was leaving his liquor store in Harlem and driving home to Glen Cove, New York, and it was a stormy night, and he didn't have snow tires because he was driving a rental car, and the pavement was slippery, and he lost control of the car, and the car slammed into a pole, and he was paralyzed. And when I started doing the research for this book, I started to realize that there was more to the story. Again, Buzzy Bevesi comes into play here. He wouldn't say exactly what happened, but he just said, Buzzy Bevesi was funny, he was emailing me. This is a 95-year-old gentleman who was using email, which was really rather amazing. I was quite impressed by that. But he said something to the effect, he said, Kempe was somewhere he shouldn't have been that night. I was like, okay, what does that mean? Then I managed to dig up some friends of Roy Campanella's wife at the time, his second wife, Ruthie. I found this woman whose name was Ruth Bowen. Was it Ruth Bowen or Barbara Bowen? I don't know. Anyway, her name was, I think it was Barbara Bowen. She was actually Dinah Washington's manager, very well known as a promoter for many, many years. She recently passed away. But anyway, she was friends with the Campanelles at the time, and I just called her up, talked to her about it, and she said, Kempe was with another woman that night. I said, whoa, I never heard that before. So that was the second confirmation. Then I talked to Roger Kahn, went up to see Roger Kahn up in, where I can't remember where he lives, but I did pay a pilgrimage to him. Roger had many things to say, and he said, yeah, it's true. I said, well, why didn't you write about it? And he said, we just didn't write about that kind of stuff. And we kept, you know, in those days, the press cared for the players. I mean, they took care of them. They hid those kind of things. So to make a long story short, what I think happened, I've pieced together, chalked on these people, is that Kempe left his liquor store that night, went to the home of this other woman. He was having an affair at the time. From the home of the other woman, he then drove home late that night. and he fell asleep at the wheel. And that came from a couple of the cops who were on site, who I managed to track down, who are still living, and they said they thought he fell asleep at the wheel. And of course, the real tragedy is that there was no seatbelt in his car. If he had a seatbelt, it's almost definitive he would not have been paralyzed. Now, in the 50s, seatbelts were optional. Very few people had them in the cars, and you know, so he was just basically folded up like a pretzel in that car, and he had spinal cord damage immediately. He was a quadriplegic at that point for the rest of his life. Right. So he could have died. He was actually, in some ways, was lucky to come out alive from that. He had a very high infection a couple of days later. But he pulled through. And as I said, he spent 35 years in a chair, which is really remarkable. Even today, the mortality rate is very high for people with those kind of injuries. If you think in our own time, Christopher Reeve, for example, I think he lived 10 years, if he even lived 10 years. And the problem is they sit all the time. And because they sit, they get bed sores. And that gets infected, and then they die of some kind of infection, septicemia or something like that. I think that's what happened to Christopher Reeve, actually. So even today, with the better care and the better cushions and things like that, the lifespan is not necessarily that long. So the fact that Campy lived 35 years says something about him as a person. He still wanted to live. There were times he didn't initially after the accident occurred. And the very good care he received from he was in the Rusk Institute here, and then later his third wife took very good care of him as well.
Yeah, he basically kind of split his life in two in years as
That's
well.
It's called The Two Lives of Roy Campanile.
Exactly. Which,
that wasn't perfect. My title. That was the publisher's title.
That they did very well. Because when I first saw that, I was not sure what that was other than second life.
Some reviews of the book said, well, I don't know what that even means. Does it mean his Negro League life and his professional baseball life? Does it mean that there was a secret side of him? And I don't know. I didn't make up the title. I think the title is supposed to be, his life in the wheelchair and his life in baseball.
Yeah,
I
would say. No.
But then some people say, well, you didn't write. Half the book is not about his life in the wheelchair. Well, I know it's not. I mean, I couldn't put 30. I mean, it's a 400-page book, and about 300 pages of it is about his baseball life, not as much about his life in a wheelchair. But there is certainly some coverage of it, but it's not half of the book.
Yeah, no, I just never realized really until this, I guess by the pure years, that half of his life was one way.
Because he died in 1993. He was 71. So yeah, it's pretty much down the middle.
Right.
Pretty much down the middle.
Now, it seems as though, which you alluded to, that he had a little bit of a complicated relationship with his three wives.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm correct, you had over. You interviewed over 100 people for this book, did exhaustive research, but none of his children were willing to cooperate with you.
That is correct. Early on in the project, I did speak to his stepchildren, who actually are the ones who control his estate. His third marriage, the kids from his third marriage, are the ones who are most involved in his estate. And they said, okay, we will cooperate. And then it became, well, we got to get all the children on board. And now there's children from three different marriages, five kids, I think. And then his son, Roy Campanella Jr., wanted to talk to me, and then I had to send them questions. I mean, it was a process that went on for almost 2 or 3 years of trying to get them to cooperate. And eventually he just said, no, we won't cooperate. They bailed out. I don't know how forthcoming they would have been anyway. I have a feeling they're probably not that happy with this book. I think it's I was saying to you before, I think it's a fair book. I don't think it's a hatchet job, but it's not a it's an honest portrait of him. He had warts, like everyone does. I think it makes him more interesting as a person that you get to see those sides. And if I just written a 400-page glossy, you know, well scrubbed image, I mean, then you can go back and read his autobiography. It's good to be alive. I mean, that's what he wanted the world to see. But behind there was another side to him.
Well, you did a terrific job.
Thank you.
And let's see if there's any questions from our bleachers and our gallery.
Thank you, Neil, for your very passionate presentation, which came through in the book as well.
Thank you.
And I think we're always addressed to the relationship between Jackie and Campy. And Jackie was on a mission, the civil rights mission. And Campy, the way he wrote about it, was just so happy to be included, and he was content with that. But my question to you would be, if he were here tonight, if he were alive now and here tonight, do you think he, in hindsight, might have wished that he had been more on the bandwagon to crusade for civil rights issues, that it was more than just a baseball story?
Mm-hmm. I think many players would have felt, yes, I think he probably would have, and I think many players felt the same way. I think I have a quote in the book from Monty Irvin, who said pretty much that in the early 60s. He said, you know, we all should have stuck our necks out more than we did. But I think in the 50s, so many people were, they were so afraid that if they did something wrong, it might all end. You know, it might, there's a quote from Campy out in the book, he says, you got to walk the chalk line all the time. In the, you know, if you stray from that, who knows what's going to happen. I think Ricky also had drilled into their heads, you got to behave, you can't say anything. So I think Campy was always afraid it might be taken away from him, and that those bad old days of the Negro Leagues might somehow come back, even though they weren't going to. And I think he was naive in thinking that gradualism was going to be the answer to civil rights. In other words, things are getting better year by year, but you know, we don't need to protest. But I think by the early 60s, he realized, yeah, it's not going to work. You have to stick your neck out. So I do think he probably would have regretted it. Jackie, as I said, was a lone wolf. He really was. I can't think of any other black athlete or black celebrity in the 50s who was so outspoken. I mean, again, think of a comparison to someone like, say, Nat King Cole, who was a very, very famous individual in the 50s, who also got a lot of criticism because he didn't speak out at all. He wouldn't say anything about civil rights issues in the 50s, and people jumped down his throat for the same reason. Althea Gibson, the great black tennis player in the 50s, same thing. She didn't speak out. So I think generally most black athletes just, they felt they were lucky to be where they were in the 50s, and they just didn't want to say anything. But yeah, I think there was regret later on in Roy's perspective. And Jackie himself said that. Jackie said something to the effect like, I used to tell Roy, someday you're going to have to tell your son what you did and did not do in the 50s. You know, and that was Jackie. So, I think there was a little bit of that feeling, that regret later on. Yes?
I just think along the same line, Jackie was a totally different guy than most of any other black athletes. He went to college. Not only did he go to college, he was a tremendous athlete in multiple sports. Goes into the service, he just didn't go into the private. He was an officer in the Army. So when he came out, I felt it was almost like an arrogance. But he was in an area that a lot of other black people never came, young guys. If they were athletes, especially, they just played ball, whether it was football or baseball or basketball. And that's where they made their mark. So they might have felt, you know, this guy is appeal.
I think you're 100% right. In fact, Erskine, when I talked to him, Carl Erskine said something. He said, you know, Jackie, I think he had the feeling that I could be doing so much more. I mean, I've got a great mind. I should be in business. I should be in politics. This is belief. Baseball is always beneath me. I got to do this to get somewhere, but it's not what I want to really do.
You know, I said it earlier to some people out here. It was like Bill Bradley on the Knicks. The same thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you know, Jackie himself said, I have a quote in the book about, he wins the MVP in 1949, and he says, I can't wait to quit. He's already, in the year after he wins, he's like, baseball was just, it was a means to an end, but, you know, people like Campy, baseball was their life. They thought about it, they talked about it, they wanted to stay in it. Campy would have been baseball to the day he died if he could. If he hadn't been the accident, he would have managed. He would have loved to have managed. Jackie had bigger and better things in mind because he had, as you say, he had that education. He had an education beyond not just black players, but 95% of the white players at the time didn't have that education.
Chock full of nuts. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot
of players that are coming out right now who have been sexually abused, and they didn't say anything because they were afraid it was all going to go away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yep. It's that pressure, you know, no matter what. Mm-hmm.
I think you just made an excellent point that Jackie went to become VP at Chock Full of Nuts. And then if you juxtapose that with what Campy did and went straight to Harlem and opened that liquor store, there it is right there. Right. Because right. That's the dynamic between those two.
Mm-hmm. Although, you know, Campy probably would have said, well, you know what, I made more money in my liquor store.
It's an entrepreneurial approach to, and that's what Negro League Baseball was, an entrepreneurial mindset.
Mm-hmm.
You got to sell tickets, right?
Mm-hmm.
People out here to watch this ball game. These teams have to be doing something daring. On the other side, the game of baseball itself is still a very corporate environment, so I can see the difference between those two personalities and the path they both took.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
From Jackie's perspective, it could be hard to sort out, because I could see how he would bear some resentment toward Campy for not pulling his weight for the bigger picture. But at the same time, it's conceivable to me that he may have been also envious of Campy, because Campy, with his three MVPs, may have been a better player, and that wasn't supposed to have happened.
I think Jackie's a little envious of Campy's popularity. There were years in the 50s where Campy had more All-Star votes than any other player in baseball. I mean, more than DiMaggio and Williams and Mays. I mean, he was enormously popular. And to win three MVPs, you've got to have the writers on your side, and Campy did. Jackie did not, and Jackie, in so many words, kind of said, well, if I'd kissed a few more writers' butts, I might have won another MVP or two. I mean, I think there was a little resentment that Campy played the game and got the goodies, and Jackie didn't always play the game and got a lot of the grief from the media at the time, which was very much white-dominated. So, and Campy was a hell of a player. You know, and Campy, in 1945, when Jackie was signed by the Dodgers, most people would have said, Campy's a better player. Campy had played in the Negro Leagues for years. Jackie had played 1 year in the Negro Leagues, didn't have that much experience. So, Campy had played much more baseball, had much more of that background. So,
is the tribute game at the Coliseum in 58 or 59 still the largest crowd ever see a baseball game?
They beat it a couple of years ago. They did it as kind of a stunt. The Red Sox did. The Red Sox played, who did they play, the Angels or someone? But they intentionally kind of did it as an attempt to beat that record. They did beat it.
It was in 08 for the 50th anniversary.
Right.
Second question. I vaguely recall this. Did not Campy and Drysdale die within 24 hours
of
each other?
Very, very close. It was within a week at least. It was the summer of 93, they both died. I think it was Drysdale was first, if I recall correctly. No, it couldn't be, because Drysdale was quoted after Campy died. I think Drysdale died maybe a week after Campy did. Very, very close together. Yes?
It's sort of interesting, the reticence of the players in the 50s to speak out, and Robinson off by himself there on the civil rights issue. A decade later, same thing sort of happened again with Curt Flood and the reserve clause issue.
Robinson testified at that, actually,
a lot of players from that year or today said, oh, they really should have spoken out and all of that. The second question, though, you mentioned about the relationship with some of the Southern players on the Dodgers. There have been some stories, some of which have been denied, about Carl Furillo being sort of having some prejudiced bones in his body. Did you come across any?
I heard that when he first came up. When Jackie came up in 47, Furillo basically said, I'm not going to play with him. You know, but by 48, 49, he did kind of come around to appreciating Jackie's skills, put it that way. I don't think Furillo was ever going to be the most open-minded individual when it came to race, but I think he did get along reasonably well with the black players. But I would say when Jackie first came in, I don't know if it was Kahn or someone else to whom I interviewed them, they said that basically Furillo was, was absolutely horrified by the thought of having a black man on the team. But as I said, he got used to it, and he came around.
Those ring for, pennants helps.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. When you think of the Dodgers in those years, and they had three great, Campy, Jackie, and Newcomb, three great players. Who Brantley spent no money on, incidentally. He did not spend a dime on any of them. He got them all for free. He grabbed them out of the Negro without compensating them. They were outstanding. They were the cornerstone of that team. I mean, the Dodgers' success was so much built on the success on the backs of those three players. I mean, that really transformed them. So, yeah, I think that did help, having great players by your side who contribute so much to your success. How can you not?
Furillo came up in 46. So when Jackie came on in 47, he was not a veteran. He was in no position to make any squawk. But I have a different question, which is, can you tell us something about how Campy got along with his three managers?
Ah, that's a good question. Well, let me see. Okay, he came up in 48, and DeRocher was the manager at the time. And he liked DeRocher, actually. He thought DeRocher was a more aggressive roll-the-dice kind of manager. Of course, Jackie hated DeRocher with a purple passion, as I think everyone knows. He despised DeRocher. That DeRocher, of course, was fired in the middle of 48. Some of it was over Campy, because DeRocher wanted Campy brought up from St. Paul, and Ricky wanted to keep him down in St. Paul so he could integrate the American Association. That's the whole other story. Then they brought back Bert Schotten, who everyone knows, kindly old Bert Schotten, as what Dick Young used to call him. Campy thought Bert Schotten was kind of dull, drab, didn't do much of anything, didn't move from the dugout, didn't think he was too adventurous as a manager. In fact, Campy lumped together Alston and Schotten as those kind of managers. He lumped Dressen and DeRocher together as being more willing to gamble. Campy apparently did have a little bit of a falling out with Dressen at the end. Dressen, Kahn told me this, that Dressen one time accused Campy of being a high school catcher, by the way, he called too many curves or something like that. Campy was really angry about that. And of course, Dressen was a loudmouth anyway, always was, would rip players apart at the slightest provocation. But as I said, I think Campy liked DeRocher and Dressen strategically. Alston and Schotten, he thought they were a little too boring in their play calling, but liked them personally because they treated him reasonably well. Yes?
You mentioned the fact that Campanella probably was a better all-around ball player than Jackie Robinson, or a better ball player. Of course, Branch Rickey was looking for not only a good ball player, but somebody that he thought could withstand the prejudices and so forth. And that was really as key as the fact that he was a great ball player.
Yeah, I agree with you. And Rickey himself said, I didn't even know who Campanella was until after I had signed Jack. In other words, he said he had not really even scouted him that closely. He wasn't even that aware of him. So the guy I think could have done it is Monty Irvin. Because Monty Irvin had the college education. Monty Irvin had the college education. He was a great ball player in the Negro Leagues. I think he could have done it. The problem, I got into this in the book a little bit briefly. The problem that Monty ran into was really just bad luck. He was in the service, and he came back in 45, and he had like kind of shell shock. So he really wasn't himself. And when Rickey was starting to scout, he hadn't really seen Irvin play much. So I think if he had seen Irvin, he might have also been a very good candidate. And he was the same age as Jackie, both born in 1919, and Monty Irvin's still with us. And great guy. I talked to him in writing the book. He has a great memory, and he was very close to Campy. And his relationship with Jackie was pretty stormy himself. He had a few tart remarks to make about Jackie. Not that he hated him or anything, he just felt that Jackie could be difficult. And he... Jackie's personality-wise could be he was brusque at times. He was he had a point. He made his point. He didn't care if he stepped on other people's toes, and that was the impression I got from Irvin when I talked to him.
The other thing I wanted to bring out is about they talk about the fact that when Pee Wee Reese actually put his arms around the shoulders of Jackie Robinson, that's when he really had it made from that point on, as far as most of the Dodgers.
Yeah, and then they never know exactly what year that happened. I know there was a book a few years ago about Jackie, and they said, well, did it happen in 47 or 48 when Pee Wee did the famous putting the arm around the shoulder? There's no question that Reese was the glue that held that team together. And what Reese said went, and if Reese got along with those players, and he was the captain, and he really he ran the show, and I think that was so important, his embracing of Jackie, that symbolic hat and shoulder. And also with Campy, too. I mean, when Reese
was also a Southerner, which
he was a Southerner. You're right. He's a Kentuckian, and he
across the border in Cincinnati.
Yep, yeah. And he made that step. So yeah, Reese was a remarkable individual. Also, always surprised me he never managed. I talked to Buzzy Bavese about that issue, and he said he told me he never wanted the headache of managing. You know, there was times when he was talked about replacing Alston or replacing Dressen, and he just didn't want it. I'm sorry, you said something about him being in Houston or about Monty? He did move to Houston. Yeah, he was living in Florida and he moved to Houston. When I contacted him, he had just moved to Houston. I think he's still there.
He's still with his daughter.
Is he living there with his daughter?
He's about 94, 93.
I think so. He was sharp as a tack when I talked to him, though.
Yeah.
Yes?
I'd like to ask you this question regarding Campy and his catching skills. No one's talked about who helped him develop that. And then secondly, everybody's heard of the shot around the world, and Campy didn't play that day.
No.
So I'm not going to say talk about so-and-so. I'm going to ask you, can you give us a little bit more about that?
Well, the first thing he mentioned is that the guy who had the most to do with Campy's catching was Biz Mackey. He was a great Negro League player. When Campy came to the Washington Eli Giants in 1937, the manager was this guy named Biz Mackey. who'd been in the Negro Leagues forever and could do everything, play everything. He was, at that point, he was winding down, but he took Campy aside and basically turned him into, he took this kid and turned him into a professional catcher. So Campy always attributed his catching to Bismacki, his skills. As far as 51, in the first game of the 51 playoff, it was the last day of the season. In the last game of the season against the Phillies in 1951, Campy hit a triple. And while he was rounding second, he blew out his thigh muscle or something like that. So he held on the rest of the game, caught the rest of that game, caught the first game of the three-game playoff, but he was like a statue behind home plate. He couldn't move. In fact, he hit into a double play where he should never have been out at first because he could not even run. So basically he told Dressen, I can't play at this point. Now, years later, Campy would say, I could have played, they should have let me play, but at the time he could not have played. So yes, Campy's sitting on the bench in game three, and of course the story is that Campy's out there catching, he goes out and talks to Don Newcomb and gets him through that inning somehow, or he tells Ralph Branca, don't throw another pitch like that to Bobby Thompson, I'm going to kill you. But the funny thing is, I did find a couple days after the series, there was a quote in one of the newspapers from Dressen, and Dressen said that. Dressen said, if Campy's behind the plate, he goes out there and talks to Branca, he doesn't throw that pitch. So maybe that's just a little Monday morning quarterbacking, but you never know. On the other hand, Rube Walker hit a huge home run the day before and had done a reasonably good job in the playoffs, but certainly Campy had a hell of a year in 51. He was MVP, and not having him there in those games may have had an impact, but Dodgers were just cursed that year, and the signing still didn't help.
Say 2 words about Hodman and Branca.
About who and Branca?
Hodman, Gil Hodges.
Gil Hodges and Branca? As far as Campy's relationship with them, or Campy got along very well with both of them. I think Branca, I was telling Jay before that I thought, I tried to get a hold of Branca to talk for this book, but Branca told me, he said, you know, I don't talk to writers anymore, I've been lied to too many times. So I couldn't get him on tape about Campy because I was interested to hear what he thought about him. Hodges, Campy always just thought he was a great player. You know, wonderful first baseman and very quiet, didn't always get his due in the 50s. And I think Campy, one thing I think Campy probably felt bad about when he saw all his ex-teammates becoming managers later on and having success, you know, it's like Hodges and like Dick Williams and Yogi Berra, who he was fairly close with. And Campy always wanted to manage, and he was envisioned as being one of the first black managers. It's funny, even after his accident, he still hoped to manage. I found this letter he wrote to Walter O'Malley in the 60s saying, you know, the Dodgers aren't doing very well. I'm writing to say that I'd like to apply for the position of manager for the Los Angeles Dodgers. I wish I got the response. I never got to see the answer. You know, the O'Malley family has all these wonderful documents. Unfortunately, they don't let anyone see them. That one happens to be online on the Walter O'Malley website. But I always wonder what O'Malley wrote back to him. Because, you know, Campy physically couldn't have managed anyway. But he did still think, he still hoped to manage, even in the 60s. Walter didn't let go of that job anyway. They kept him on for another 15 years. But I think that was one of the great disappointments in Campy's life, that he could not manage. Because I think he really wanted to do that, or at least coach. And once he was in a wheelchair, he couldn't do anything. I mean, he could not do much of anything baseball wise. Yes.
Growing up, second only to the Mantle Mays Snyder debate with the Campanella Barra debate. Statistically, how do their careers shape up, and how would you compare them defensively as catchers?
I think Campy's a better catcher defensively, and the thing that's the most striking is Campy's throwing percentages, which were unbelievable. He was throwing out like 65% of the runners who stole on him in the 50s. I mean, way ahead of everyone else. So I think he had the best throwing arm in the 50s by far. Barra may have been a better overall hitter than Campy. I have a hard time comparing the two of them because Campy spent so much time in the Negro Leagues that he might have left some of his best years there. I mean, he didn't come to the majors until he was 26. And he was worked to death in the Negro Leagues where they catch, you know, three games a day. And then he'd go play where baseball. I mean, he was playing baseball year-round all throughout his 20s. So by the time he got to the majors, I think there was a tremendous amount of miles on him. He might have performed even better had he had the standard development, like someone like Barra, who started in the minor leagues. I don't know where he was at first. Went to the minors a couple years, went to the Yankees and spent his career at the Yankees, where Campy probably caught about 1,200 games before he ever went to the major leagues. Yeah. But I would say they were both great players. I would say I think Campy has the edge defensively. That would be my biggest sense. And Campy played at Ebbets Field, which gave him an edge as far as, you know, he's a Deadpool hitter, hit a lot of home runs there. He might not have.
Wouldn't have side. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's they were both great. I have a quote in the book of a couple of Italian guys talking about Berra and Campanella. They're arguing. They both finally come to the conclusion. What difference does it make? They're both Italian. So that's kind of that's I think kind of the mindset there.
One other comparative question. It seems like modern day contemporary experts seem to give Johnny Bench like the hands down the greatest catcher of all time. I don't see that. What did Bench have that Berra and Campanella didn't?
Well, Bench was great defensively. I have to say that. I mean, and he hit in an era where the offense was less. So I think people probably give him credit for that. I'd say Bench has got to be in the top five. I'd say Bench, Berra, Campanella. I think Josh Gibson's got to be there too. And then you got the people like Mickey Cochran and Bill Dickey, who were great heroes of Campy's as a kid. He was a huge fan of Major League Baseball, and he loved those two guys. Bill Dickey fans out there? Or
my dad.
He's in the top five.
Yeah. Seven guys in the top five.
Okay, well, we have some ties there. But yeah, I mean, I would put them in my list. As I said, Gabby Harden is from my hometown on Soccer Rhode Island, so you could throw Gabby Harden in there too. But yeah, I think Campy has been forgotten because he's been gone so long. He's been deceased for almost 18 years now. Yogi's still with us, fortunately, and I think Yogi's memory has continued. You got the Yogi Berra Museum there, so I think it's kept his name out there. But I think people in the 50s, I think a lot of people would probably have chosen Campy. I know the Sporting News did like a poll at one point in the 50s. Who's the best, Campy or Berra? And they had people writing arguments back and forth. And Campy won that poll. It was an unscientific poll, of course. But in their heyday, I think a lot of people probably would have chosen Campy. Now, Berra, of course, had the edge in the World Series. He was a killer in those World Series, and the Yankees won all those World Series. And so you got to give Berra that. So.
And then the other thing that I think you just touched on, Neil, is that the name Campanella doesn't have the resonance anymore because the kids aren't talking.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. The legacy has been, I think.
They had some kind of Roy Campanella foundation, and that seems to have fallen by the way. It was supposed to help people with spinal cord injuries. That seems to have fallen by the wayside. I really do, and I think there's a lot of infighting in that family, from what I understand. The three sets of children are all arguing, and then when Campy, his last wife died, she sold all of his memorabilia, including his three MVPs. She auctioned them all off, which was sort of a tragedy. I know one of the Dodger organizations around here was trying to get something of Campy's memorabilia. She didn't give him anything. Well, the family didn't give him anything. And his MVPs, they racked up a lot of money. I mean, I was surprised how much he got for those MVPs. So. All of his stuff is gone, and as you said, yeah, I think the family not speaking is not helping his legacy much.
You'd be surprised, though, from my generation, how many people don't even know the history. I mean, I remember when I was out in Los Angeles, I was wearing a Dodger cap going to this acting class out there, and the lady was like, "Oh, what's the B stand for?" And I was like, "Oh, it's Brooklyn Dodgers." She's like, "Oh, no, really, what does it stand for?" And then even at a Met game, I heard a father explaining to his son about how the Giants and the Dodgers used to be there. He's like, "Oh, really?" I did. It's like, I'm amazed, that, and there needs to be an education of...
I agree, and I think one of the problems, even for me in marketing this book, that there is no Dodger team to plug into anymore. In other words, Stan Musial, you have George Vexey next week with his Stan Musial book.
Right.
And Musial's still around, and the Cardinals are still around, who they honor Stan Musial. And there's really no one to honor Roy Campanella anymore. I mean, the Los Angeles Dodgers try to tie, they do a little bit of work with the Brooklyn Dodgers stuff. And Campy did go to Los Angeles and live there for a while. But, a lot of the Brooklyn Dodger fans are getting older, and I think the memories of the team are fading, unfortunately. So I think there does need to be a re-education of the Brooklyn Dodgers.
And what I think it's the one team, though. I mean, I do think like the older generation, which is the Dodger fans, are educating their grandchildren. In other words, they're such passionate fans. The memories are so real. I mean, the same thing with the New York Giants. They don't get as much attention as the Brooklyn Dodgers, but I still think that the kind of history that meant so much to the grandparent generation is being passed down of that one team more than any other team.
And there needs to be. I mean, they are the most important team, baseball team of the 20th century, from a historical standpoint, because they are the first great integrated team in Jackie Robinson's position and all the players who came with him. So people do need to know about them, and they need to be honored.
I think it's everything. I mean, I think the history in every way is not learned anymore. I mean, it's a tragedy, you know, in every field. And we are baseball people here tonight, but I'm saying I want my grandson to know about the New York Giants baseball team, the Brooklyn Dodgers, and not just New York teams, but, you know, one of the things, I happened to be at Yankee Stadium working on something this week, and I stopped at Babe Ruth Way, and there was somebody reading the same sign as I was reading, and it was about Babe, which is his 60th home run, against Washington. And the person said, oh, I didn't know Babe Ruth played against the Nationals. They should have put Washington Senators. You know, but this, whoever wrote this.
The Nationals was actually a second nickname of the Senators, but obviously
it
Senators.
It goes back and forth, but the Babe's 60th home run was against the Senators.
True.
So what I'm getting at is they should just not put Senators next to Washington.
Yeah,
so whoever wrote this was obviously was somebody younger. And there was another reference to something else, and I'm thinking they need to insert these names, these teams.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Well, for those of you listening to the podcast, it's your unfortunate nature that we're going to have to end this because of a time factor. To those of you still in the clubhouse, you're the fortunate ones, and not nearly as fortunate as I feel. All I did was open the door, ask a few questions, sit back, have a beer, and we had such knowledgeable and passionate baseball fans, people who truly love baseball, in the presence of an author who... It's not often that you meet someone who's a historian and an expert, a true expert. It's kind of like you're the Roy Campanella of writers. And, you know, whatever we were throwing at you, whatever they were throwing at you, you had the answer. And it's really been a pleasure. And once again, the book, please pick this up if you have not. Campy, The Two Lies of Roy Campanella by Neil Langto, published by Simon & Schuster. And Neil, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.